You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, December 16th, 2020. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Marshall Steinbaum on the unlikely antitrust showdown. Meanwhile, Mitch McConnell acknowledges Biden's election and then proceeds to roll Democratic leadership on COVID relief. Meanwhile, the Progressive Caucus waves flexing its muscle in that very deal. California orders thousands of body bags in the anticipation of more COVID deaths. Meanwhile, the highly effective Moderna vaccine is on the brink of FDA approval. U.S. negotiating a deal with Pfizer for more doses. And a report, Florida appears to have manipulated death reporting in the lead up to the general election. Joe Biden announces, or I should say, reportedly to a name, Jennifer Granholm, Energy Secretary, Pete Buttigieg at Transportation. And after Uber spends millions of dollars on a successful assault on labor law in California, it raises its prices. And lastly, Arkansas anti-abortion law could be headed to the Supreme Court in the beginning of multiple tests of this new court's disposition towards a woman's right to choose. All this and more on today's program. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome. Thank you for joining us on today's program. We have University of Utah Professor Marshall Steinbaum on a really interesting lawsuit that is taking place in a sport that I am not that familiar with. Emma Vigeland, who is our resident sports expert. Are you at a UFC?
No.
You don't do any mixed martial arts?
Look, I respect that people like it. It is, and I like football, so saying something's too violent for me, I think that means it's too violent, but
right.
To each their own.
Fair enough. But it is the qualities of the sport aside, this is a... an extraordinary case that just got approval as a class action. And it is a case being brought by labor, essentially, but on antitrust principles. We will talk to Marshall about that. And also, he is a real authority on the implications of forgiving college loans, and we have many questions to ask him on that as well. This just breaking, there is, and we're going to be talking about the stimulus today. There's a lot of different angles to this story, but as of just moments ago, congressional negotiators, as reported by Politico, are on the brink of a coronavirus rescue package that will include a round of direct payments. And it's interesting to note how we got here, because as of yesterday, there were no direct payments that were going to be included in this. Now, of course, the first round, if you'll remember the CARES Act, Emma, was $1,200 direct payment to folks, I believe, under $75,000 income the prior year. And the payment they're talking about now is about half that. But as of yesterday, there was no payment in this deal.
Certainly.
If folks can recall, House has already passed multiple different packages that have languished. The Senate now, there is a gang of four, although the numbers are not quite clear, but it's a bipartisan gang, if you will. Two Democrats, two Republicans, it appears at the moment, but they've all been sort of moving in and out of that space. And that bill was that or proposal they had ended up getting split into two parts. One was relief in terms of extension on unemployment benefits, an augmentation to unemployment benefits. So an extra $300 per week provided by the feds on top of the extension of unemployment benefits, which most unemployment benefits come from the state. It also would have provided an extension on the eviction moratorium until Joe Biden gets into office, and there he can by executive action implement that again, and some rental assistance, as well as another tranche of PPP money, that is the Paycheck Protection Program. We'll get into all of this a little bit later in the program, but there was no direct payments.
It seems clear that the leveraging of their power, or the flexing of their muscle, as you put it, of the progressives led by Pramila Jayapal in the House, and then also Bernie Sanders joined by Republican Josh Hawley in the Senate, who were taking to the Senate floor demanding stimulus checks, seems to have worked. And it's a pretty quick turnaround, especially because McConnell's feeling the heat when it comes to Georgia.
Well, yes. And last night it was reported by Politico reporter. She's the co-congressional bureau chief of Politico, Heather Cagle. And she reported that the Progressive Caucus is taking a hard line and voting against any proposal that didn't include stimulus checks. That means direct payments. Pramila Jayapal raised the idea during a CPC call tonight. Again, this was reported last night. Members appeared to be receptive to the plan. The group is now whipping the idea, requesting members respond by noon tomorrow on two questions. If the Omni-COVID deal doesn't include direct payments, would they be willing to oppose the rule? Would they also be willing to oppose the bill? And so we don't know what came back from that, but I think just the idea that they were starting to whip this. Now, this, and as Cagle also writes, this comes after the CPC, the Congressional Progressive Caucus, instituted a bunch of rule changes. They changed their leadership up. Jayapal became the chair as opposed to the co-chair, and they only having one chair. Katie Porter became number two, and Ilhan Omar became their whip. And the other thing they'd said, they had implemented a bunch of rules changes where it would become more member oriented. And one of the things that we had talked about with AOC months ago on this program was that the Progressive Caucus, and it's about 100, I'm not sure, I don't know the numbers.
It's a little over 100 members.
100 plus members strong. However, the only requirement to get into the Progressive Caucus is that, A, you want the branding of being a progressive, which
that's the chief
you reason. You can deploy when you want to.
Yeah.
And then the other requirement is that you pay $4,000 in dues, which presumably is deployed for congressional races. And no requirements that you take certain votes, no requirements that you agree to certain positions. And that, of course, cuts into the efficacy of that group. And so now they seem to be basically saying, we are willing to begin to narrow the numbers that we have, but become more solid and more of a voting block and more powerful in that respect.
Well, learning from Republicans how to wield the power of your caucus. They do that extremely effectively. And the Congressional Progressive Caucus by design has been neutered, in my view, to be such a broad tent that it doesn't wield enough actual power. And Jayapal, who is a great, great progressive, is already diverting from that, which is encouraging.
Yeah. And I'm not sure that it was built that way. I just think that for a long time, there was within the Democratic Party not a strong, and by the, and by Democratic Party, I'm not talking about electeds. I'm talking about in terms of the people out there, the people who identify as Democrats or vote Democratic, in elections. There was just simply not the critical mass of power on the left. Now, I'm not saying, I don't want to overstate things, but certainly the Democratic Party, has gotten, and I think our society at large, half of it has gone a different direction, more, a little bit less maybe, but progressives have become more progressive. And over the past 5 or 6 years, maybe 10 years or so. And so I think we're starting to see a reflection of that. There's more demands on it. And certainly the and I think part of it is also, frankly, is the freshman class that came in 2018 mm-hmm. with people like Katie Porter, with people like AOC and the squad. And we see that their numbers have increased now. And
you can see what they're doing here as kind of a mirror effect of what Republicans did with the House Freedom Caucus.
Yes.
Which was, you know, Tea Party members.
Well, the Freedom Caucus, we never knew the numbers. It was secret. And so we don't know if it was 20 or 30, and they wielded a tremendous amount of power. Now, of course, the rest of the party was also fairly like-minded and was certainly trending in that direction. But that is the model. And so that's where we are as of now. However, here is the irony is here is Joe Manchin yesterday asked to respond to Bernie Sanders' criticism of the Democrats self-negotiating because and Bernie Sanders isn't the only one saying this. The former chief of staff for Harry Reid was on Twitter, Adam Gentleson, I think is his name.
And whatever your issues with Harry Reid, he fought Republicans way more than, I don't know,
Chuck Schumer.
Current leadership.
Yes, yeah. I think so. And without a doubt. And to the extent that he was not successful, he was undercut by Joe Biden, frankly, in negotiations. We don't need to cover that that ground at the moment. But Gentleson had this to say on Twitter last night. McConnell is upbeat, has reports that Mitch McConnell is very upbeat about the negotiations as of last night, because he is getting what he wants, the least amount of aid injected into the economy while still passing a bill before the Georgia runoffs. Democrats are upbeat because they love doing deals, even when that deal is giving McConnell everything he wants. Let's remember, folks, where this has gone. Back in April, late March, early April, the Republicans wanted another tranche of the PPP. This is the Paycheck Protection Program. Sends money, ostensibly, to small businesses and says, here is a loan. If you spend this loan within 8 weeks and you do it exclusively on your labor costs and rent, then we will forgive that loan. It becomes a grant. Now, in the second tranche, Republicans, I think, wanted approximately $250 billion. Democrats came back and said $400 billion. It's unclear why there needed to be more money. There did need to be reforms in terms of who had access to this money, because if you had a
Shake Shack's getting access to it,
the small business. But the idea is that if you had a pre-existing relationship with a bank, which most small businesses, some do, but most don't. I mean, because they're too small. If you have a good relationship with a bank, you're on the top of their list to have their forms go through. And a lot of people, and particularly women-owned businesses and minority-owned businesses, did not have those relationships. That type of reform was important because there was really no system to set this whole thing up. The extra money was unclear, but Nancy Pelosi received a lot of criticism at the time, not the least of which from Andrew Cuomo. You need to get state and city funding in that because you have the leverage now. The Republicans want more paycheck protection. You have the leverage. Nancy Pelosi was highly dismissive of those people, of anyone who was critical of her not using that leverage to get city and state. She vowed in April We will get it. Believe me, we're going to get it. Here we are 12 months later. Still don't get it. We're not going to get it in this deal, no matter what happens, because it's tied into that corporate responsibility, you know, the corporate liability protections.
McConnell's pet project
and the also the Chamber of Commerce's pet project. And so we have these two separate bills now. One has the so-called controversial stuff. And now we have money left over from Paycheck Protection, money left over from the Treasury backing some of the corporate loans that went out. That money's being shifted over. So
over $500 billion, which covers more than half of this section of the bill.
Indeed. And so we're not talking a lot of new money. So it's not that expensive to the country, if that is what you're concerned about at this point, which
it's
you should not be.
Republicans pretend to be concerned about.
Indeed. And so here we are where there is a charge that Democrats have been negotiating against themselves. When Mitch McConnell, if he wants to retain the Senate, this is one of the things he needs. He needs Perdue and Loeffler to say, we delivered on this anemic but existing relief bill. Here is Joe Manchin with Poppy Harlow on CNN. Being asked to respond to Bernie Sanders' criticism of the Democrats self-negotiating.
Senator Bernie Sanders and Republican Senator Josh Hawley are insisting on direct stimulus checks to folks. This does not have that. And this is what Sanders told Politico last night, quote, what kind of a negotiation is it when you go from $3.4 trillion, that's what passed the House, to $188 billion in new money that is not a negotiation, that's a collapse. What's your response to him?
Well, I hear Bernie loud and clear, and I understand where Bernie's coming from. I want to reemphasize this is an emergency package. If you're losing basically your unemployment assistance because it's not your fault that you've lost your job because businesses have closed and they're closing more, you need a lifeline. That's what this is. If you're losing your food assistance, you don't qualify for food stamps. But basically, you're in a hunger line you've never been in before. If you're losing your rent assistance or eviction notices, they're going to throw you out at the end of the year. Bernie, all I'm asking for is a lifeline for those people that are desperate right now. Joe Biden comes in as our president June 20th. He'll put another package forward. That package will be all-inclusive. It'll look at everything it takes in order to get our economy back up and roaring again. So let's look at this as an emergency lifeline through the first quarter till April 1. That's how we should be doing it.
Pretty sure that's how Bernie Sanders views it, too, which is why he is showing and discussing the urgency of having it be more robust. And there's no guarantee that they're going to have, as you would say, a second bite at the apple in 2021, because you're giving Republicans what they want here, which is the ability for Loeffler and Perdue to say that they achieved something, and then that could jeopardize the Senate. So you have to be as strong in your negotiations and as demanding for relief for those people that you're talking about, Joe Manchin, as possible.
And shortly, hours after he gave that, he made that statement on CNN, there appears to be now a bigger push to have at least a $600 direct payment to people. Now, it shows, frankly, the efficacy of what Sanders was doing in conjunction, I guess, with Hawley, in going to in front of the Senate and demanding $1,200. Now,
it embarrassed them. I mean, it was a Republican and a prominent Democrat who embarrassed the rest of the senators by saying there needs to be stimulus checks. And what do you know? And then Pramila Jayapal in the House flexing her muscle.
Indeed. And so that's where we're at. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to University of Utah Professor Marshall Steinbaum on the very surprising UFC labor antitrust showdown and also college loans. We'll be back in just a moment. In the meantime, folks, this is pretty exciting stuff.
We have props
today. I am modeling the Posit t-shirt. As you can see, there's a Majority Report logo right here, right on the sleeve, and the Posit t-shirt. And then there's just like half of my face without with like
Sam
really.
Loves wearing images or clothing with images of his face on it. That's you talk about it all the time. You only want to wear merch with your face on it.
Absolutely. In fact, but only the best features of my face, which is basically just my forehead.
Well, you got good hair, so there you go.
My
it's
forehead and my hair. There it
too.
Goes. And yeah. And the glasses, the top of the glasses. And Emma's got a left is best t-shirt.
Yeah. I don't share Sam's obsession with wearing clothing that has his face on it, so I'm going to be donning the left is best.
And that's the back, right? That's the back.
We're looking at. The front.
Oh, is that the front?
But it does have majority
report okay.
on the sleeve, which is cool, too. Nice
feature. Your left is best.
And good. You know those kinds of t-shirts that you get that they're like chalky when you get them and they're the cotton's not like this is very soft but sturdy cotton.
Well, and not only that, you'll notice it is made in the USA and it is printed by a union print shop. So all of it is union right. printed and Brendan, put up. Let's do this. Let's do it. I don't care. Let's show the hat. Show the hat. This beanie we're going to get. This baby is going to be up there very soon. And this is pretty exciting. And I think we're going to have it. Are we going to have it black and gray or just gray? I'm not sure. But here's what it's going to look like. Brendan's got it. He's going to put it up. Folks, don't forget, it's your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. And you support the free show and then you get the fun half. And there it is. There's the hat. Oh my gosh, I like that. That may actually be, you know, I'm a little hesitant to wear Majority Report branded stuff.
That's why I was joking about it.
As a kid, I was visiting New York City and ran into what was his name now? Chris Elliott.
Okay.
Okay, and this is back in the 80s. When he was doing characters on David Letterman show. Do you even know who Chris Elliott is?
I don't know who it is.
This is so cool.
I wanted to just, you know, let us move.
Do you watch Schitt's Creek?
My parents do.
Okay.
My mom does. All right. But I've seen parts of it.
Okay.
That guy Dan Levy's funny. Son of Eugene Levy.
Anyways, so Chris Elliott was walking down the street and I'm with my buddies. We're in college. With John Benjamin, actually, and Chris Elliott comes walking by. First, we see this guy. He's like wearing all David Letterman logo stuff. Armbands, hat, jacket, shirt. And we walk in and go, holy crap, it's Chris Elliott. And we're like, Chris Elliott. He's like, hey, guys. I mean, he was just completely advertising. It was so funny.
That's amazing.
But I can't get into that. So check it out. Go to our merch, shop.majorityreportradio.com. Also, you can join the show, jointhemajorityreport.com. And also subscribe on YouTube. Okay, like to welcome back to the program, Marshall Steinbaum from the University of Utah. Marshall, welcome back to the program. And we got you sideways. We're going to need you to shift your phone again, if you could. There you go. Perfect.
Is that better?
Yeah.
All right.
Great. Marshall, let's tell us. I mean, first off, for people who don't know UFC fighting, what can you tell us about this? Like, what is this?
Well, I'm hardly the person to go to for commentary on the actual sport itself. It is basically, from a sort of labor standpoint, Uber for, mixed martial arts, for individual bouts between competitors. And that's what underlies this antitrust case and the practices that lead to such low pay to the fighters themselves.
Just to be clear, so that people know, it is it's mixed martial arts, which is basically anything from, I guess, like from karate and Thai kickboxing and they fight. It's like boxing, but they their legs and whatnot. And right. This is a UFC is the biggest league I think that is out there in terms of what they call MMA.
And this gained prominence right when all of the Pikmin on the contractors is am I remembering that correctly?
I'm sorry, I missed Emma. What you just said?
This got into, I think, more of the national consciousness when I saw John Oliver do the big segment on the exploitation of these UFC fighters.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So, Sam, when you say that they're the biggest MMA promoter, I think that's true by a very long shot. The facts underlying this antitrust case essentially pertain to the decades in which it wrapped up the entire market. So there used to be many promoters, and the fighters had some power vis-a-vis the promoters, because if they didn't like the deal that was put together by any one promoter, they could go to another one, and the different promoters were essentially competing to put on the best fights for the audience that was there for them. The UFC has wrapped up that market in part by constraining the fighters to exclusive contracts, outright mergers with some of the competition, so that, you know, I think the last one was in something like 2012 or 2011 or 2012. That, you know, means that it now has over 90% of the market share, and I think essentially exclusive contracts with all of the major, the highest profile fighters. You know, so basically all of the, I mean, that's why I say it's somewhat similar to Uber, and broadly speaking to the tech platforms altogether, because they have exerted power over the fighters exactly by monopolizing the market to consumers. So essentially, the fans of the sport are, you know, fully within the UFC tent, because they're the ones with all the exclusive contracts, and they can, UFC can turn around and essentially in any negotiation with any one fighter say, you know, it's basically my way or the highway. You have nowhere else to go, so you have to agree to my terms. And these sort of exclusion on both sides of the platform is mutually reinforcing.
Okay. And I want to get into this. This is what is known as a monopsony. And I want you to, because I think people need to understand this term, because I have a feeling that people are going to hear it a lot more, in this era, because I think there is been a concerted effort and a building push for really now 5 or 6 years. It seems to me to push, for a change in the way that we interpret our antitrust laws in this country, really a return to the way it was before Ronald Reagan changed those ideas. And we should also say that you obviously have a child with a croup cough in the background there that we should.
That's a canine. That's a canine, not a human being.
No, I know. It's just far more sympathetic if people think it's your kid.
Well, he's been bought off with peanut butter, so hopefully that will.
Well done. Well done. All right. So, but tell us about this concept of monopsony, because we don't just see it. You mentioned we see it in the context of Uber. Uber has been able largely to push out a lot of its competitors in their space. You see it in the context of we have this in the context of chicken processing, across the country. We've seen this in the context of sometimes of Walmart has done this. Mm-hmm. Tell us what this idea of monopsony is, because I think people know what a monopoly is, but a monopsony is sort of the inverse on some level.
Yeah, so monopsony formally refers to one buyer in a market as opposed to one seller in the case of monopoly. And what you're all talking about is monopsony as applied to the context of labor, where people sell their labor to make their living. And if their employer has power over them, then they have to sell it on terms that are advantageous to the employer and not to the worker. I think one reason why this term has, you know, there's some misunderstanding of it in the popular imagination is because it's interpreted over literally in some cases to mean literally only one employer in a labor market. And I think that market power on the part of employers is a much more widespread phenomenon than that. I mean, to some extent, this gets into the weeds of market definition in antitrust. So, for example, applied to the UFC context, you know, they have a more than 90% share of mixed martial arts professional events broadcast on pay-per-view or something like that. And they, in defending themselves from this case, would say something like, oh, well, the fighters can go box or something else, like do a different sport. So we're not a monopsony because we have less than a 90% market share, way less if you incorporate these other things. We can get into that. I would say to refer to the sort of sea change in thinking that you're referring to in antitrust since the Reagan era, Walmart is a great example. So Walmart, you know, is a totally dominant retailer that basically spread total across the country and has representation in pretty much every market and sells tons of stuff at its stores. antitrust people operating under the old regime would consider Walmart to be a antitrust success or a competition success because they have a dominant market share, but the claim would be, oh, but they're so much more efficient. The reason why they're so dominant is because they provide so many more goods at such a lower price that all the consumers shop there. And that that consolidation represents pro-competitive consolidation, that is consumer benefiting consolidation across the retail landscape. And so if you bring labor market issues into play and monopsony, then you look at Walmart and you see terrible labor standards, you see exploited workers, low wages, unpredictable scheduling, all sorts of pathologies of the retail labor market that we're well aware of and interpreted through the lens of market power and competition or antitrust. That looks not like a competitive success, but like a competitive failure. And that's the way I certainly would look at it, taking the labor approach that I do. And I think that there's analogies to be had to the sort of reinterpretation of the Walmart experience, it's a big company that has a lot of influence on the way that the labor market works, but even way beyond that, to all sorts of other sectors, such as professional sports in this case.
Right. And we should also, reiterate, I just want to make this clear to everybody because, we're going to pound this, over the next, year or two, I believe, is, prior to, Ronald Reagan era, prior to, Robert Bork. Yes, that Bork, coming out with this idea that the only thing we should be worried about in terms of antitrust is the cost to the consumer. Prior to that, the concern about antitrust was not exclusively the cost to consumer. It was the ability of labor to get a fair deal and to be on somewhat fair grounds with the buyer of their labor, but also political power and also the ability of other firms to compete so that we have a robust economy that doesn't put all our eggs in one basket. And it really has more to do with being a citizen and a society, rather than just, the cheapest goods possible. And, we end up paying for these goods in other ways that basically these become externalities that get offloaded onto society in other ways. And so we end up supporting a lot of Walmart workers, with social services that in a healthier economy, we wouldn't have to do because their wages would rise and they'd have more benefits. So getting back to the UFC, how often do we see semi-freelancers, right? I mean, these UFC guys, are they independent contractors or are they salaried?
Yeah. Yeah, that's one of the crucial aspects of this case is that they're independent contractors, unlike the major leagues or professional leagues of other professional sports where you have unionized where the players are the athletes are unionized and there's collective bargaining under the aegis of the National Labor Relations Act. For the most part, that's not 100% the case in professional sports, but that is basically the framework that has been adopted into professional sports at the highest level. UFC is more like boxing in the sense that the athletes are independent contractors. They're not part of a team, and each professional event is sort of separately promoted or, put together, promoted by a promoter that contracts in theory on a one-off basis. I mean, if you're going to go the independent contractor route, the idea is that that preserves more autonomy for the contractor. And so, if you would imagine that, then there's not like a contract that lasts for like 20 bouts in UFC, but that is in fact what exists. So they're independent contractors. They're not represented by a union. There's not a contract negotiation such as you hear about in the NBA, for example, where, the main subject of the bargaining between the players and the league is what share of the revenue goes to the athletes. That's what they bargain over. In the UFC, there's no such collective representation like that. So the players are negotiating on a bout by bout basis. But one of the ways in which they're exploited is that they're locked into long-term contracts, and those contracts can essentially be unilaterally extended, it seems like. I mean, so there's some evidence of that from the evidence that's come forward in this case. So it's sort of the worst of both worlds for the workers. That is, they in theory, they're more autonomous, but in reality, they're not more autonomous. They just lack power. And I think that also, you know, to get back to the Uber example and some of what you were just saying about the larger sort of societal implications of Walmart, you know, the companies that use independent contractors, be they the UFC or Uber, will say, oh, you know, workers have lower status or, you know, vis-a-vis they have lower labor standards in respect to these contracts because they're independent, but instead, you know, they gain autonomy, they gain flexibility. This was a very popular talking point for the gig platforms in the context of Prop 22 in California. And it is, you know, we'll certainly be hearing more of that. That is, independent contractors give workers more flexibility, even if they lack employment status and the minimum wage and so on. And what I would say this case shows very clearly, and is also clearly shown in the actual reality of Uber and other gig economy platforms as opposed to their propaganda, is that actually under the independent contractor business model, workers lack autonomy, they lack flexibility, they can still be forced to do things, in fact, probably more so because they lack this collective bargaining framework that's available to athletes in other major sports. You know, they do not in any sense have the flexibility that the companies claim, and they have low pay. And I would say a broader sort of truth of how labor markets work is that worker power is mutually reinforcing. So if, you know, giving workers more autonomy increases their bargaining power, which means they can are in a position to claim higher pay. These, you know, so the big contradiction is, are, you know, labor standards and autonomy or flexibility substitutes or complements? My argument would be, as a labor economist, they're complements. More autonomy for workers, and that also goes for small businesses dealing with platforms or dominant buyers like Walmart. You know, the more autonomy they have, the more ability to take their business elsewhere and work with other buyers or other employers, the better position they're in to bargain with with a given employer whose conduct is in question.
All right, let me just to clarify, there's two dynamics, right? There's one on the buyer side, that being the employer at this point, mm-hmm. the UFC, and there's mm-hmm. one on the seller side. And what they're doing is they're saying that ostensibly we're part of our compensation to these sellers of their labor is that we're giving them more flexibility. That's why we're not giving them benefits. That's why we're not paying into their Social Security, because they have flexibility and they really want that flexibility. Mm-hmm. However, that's the dynamic ostensibly with the buy, but because of their business practices, they have basically offered them a Pyrrhic compensation, if you will. You have the flexibility to go anywhere you want. It just so happens, though, that our business practices have eaten up and have swallowed every other opportunity.
Right. It's like the NFL saying, yeah, you could go play in the XFL if you wanted to. We have competition. But at least the NFL provides healthcare for them. I mean, that's what's unbelievable about this UFC story, is that it's one of the most violent sports possible, and they did not provide healthcare when they were bleeding from the mouth or whatever.
Well, and the point is, they don't have to
unionize, right?
Because their business practices have been so monopolistic, we would say, right? I mean, it's so it's not really, and like you say, it's not a function of exactly how much market a share you have, although that's a piece of evidence. There is a broader sense of like how much a choice does the seller of labor at this point have in a market that has been so thoroughly, essentially, cornered by one entity.
Do you think, just a quick add on, do you think that this pushed these UFC fighters into even more dangerous physical activity because there was such little competition and they were kind of hanging by a thread in terms of their employment, because UFC could basically get rid of them whenever they wanted, and there would be new people lined up because they had no rights?
Yeah, I mean, I think all of those things play into the exercise of monopsony power. I mean, a friend of mine made the pretty amazing point that you're essentially just alluding to about this case, that, you know, by contrast, the NFL or professional boxing looks like you know, a well-structured pro-worker type of arrangement compared to the way that these people operate. And I think one of the fact that they have so much power in this sphere exactly pertains to their ability to essentially make the work as exploitative as possible, in this case, as violent as possible. So, you know, the business model very much is, you know, we will put on a spectacle of extreme violence, worker health be damned, basically, because we're not on the hook for it. All of the costs that go along with a sport that is as violent as it is are borne by the workers. So again, this is similar to Uber, where, you know, it's in Uber's interest to have all the drivers drive around as quickly as possible in an unsafe way as possible, because Uber's not on the hook for the depreciation to the cars, for auto accidents, for, you know, damage to third parties or whatever. It's like they get all of the benefits of controlling this labor force without any of the costs of liability for anything that could possibly go wrong. So, of course, they want it to be as unsafe as possible.
Say a driver's assaulted by it. Does Uber have any liability when it comes to their drivers? I'm assuming the answer is no.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not exactly the expert in a position to comment on that, but generally that question of, you know, liability to workers in the performance of their jobs is one of the things that attaches to employment status, is my understanding. So the fact that they're independent contractors means that things that they do on the job are their own problem and not the problem of the boss, because the boss is not legally the same thing as them.
And that monopsony power also incentivizes the drivers or the fighters to be more reckless, because they need to succeed within this closed environment that their employers have created.
Yeah. I mean, I used to be a bike messenger myself, thankfully not a lengthy part of my career, but it's extremely unsafe. And we were independent contractors, but, you know, basically the dispatchers had the incentive to have us bike as quickly as possible in as unsafe way as possible. So, you know, bike messengers aren't the most popular you know, people on city streets with pedestrians, certainly. But the reason why is the same reason why Uber drivers have to drive in such an unsafe manner, which is, you know, the kind of institutional setup is such that if you don't do that, then you don't get paid enough to make it, you know, make it actually make a living for you.
Right. So, okay. And so to get back to the specifics of the case, a court just found, and this is important, and I imagine this is going to have, you tell us, but implications both in the context of potentially labor law, in the context of antitrust, and to a certain extent in tort law, because these all of these independent contractors are allowed to now represent themselves as a class, which, of course, makes it a viable case, because if each person had to do it individually, the amount of work and investment that legal representation would be involved here, no individual lawyer would take this case, because they're going up against a multi-billion dollar business that will be able to sort of just wear them out. But if I'm representing all of these workers, then my investment, money and time as an attorney, that representation works. That's why class actions are so powerful, and why we see so much work on trying to limit who can actually become a class by a lot of these judges. So what are the implications so far of this case, that they've been able to bring it this far, on labor law and on antitrust? I mean, what is that? Where does this lead?
Yeah, I mean, I do hope it leads to a flourishing of multiple cases. I mean, this case was filed, I think, in 2014, and this ruling as to class certification, allowing it to move forward as a class action, came in 2020. So that's 6 years, and we haven't even gotten to a trial yet, let alone appeals and all the other things that are associated with a lengthy and high stakes antitrust proceeding like this. I do hope, you know, so the idea that independent contractors as workers can establish can meet the standard for class certification is indeed a major development that should aid similar cases from going forward. On the other hand, as you say, there have been efforts to limit class actions, including the, I think, 2019, maybe 2018 Supreme Court case, Epic Systems, which basically allowed class action waivers in employment contracts, notwithstanding the National Labor Relations Act. So lots of companies basically put, sort of pro forma class action waivers as part of their standard employment materials. So that, you know, per the finding in that case, binds their workers to forswear a class, any kind of legal proceeding, but in particular a class action one, which is the one that the kind that threatens them for most workers, as you're saying. So that really raises up the point of public enforcement. So public agencies that have the power to enforce competition laws are not bound by mandatory arbitration or class action waivers. And the other thing is that, you know, the stakes are very high in this case, because in the past, the fighters have been paid, pennies in comparison to what the company is earning. So the whole premise of the damages is that the share of revenues that's going to the fighters is way, way lower than it would be if there were free competition for their services. That's very true in this context. It means that it's viable to bring an ambitious antitrust claim like this. That's harder for workers in more sort of pedestrian occupations, where the gap between what the revenues that the boss is making off of them and what they get paid is not the gaping chasm that it is in this context. I mean, in general, it is high. That's sort of the premise of employer power in labor markets. And I think the viewers of the show have probably seen some version of the Economic Policy Institute's chart of the widening gap between output per worker and pay. So all of that, it's true, but it's hard for most workers to sustain a specific antitrust proceeding on that basis, given how hard it is. I mean, for all of the Borkist reasons we've been talking about, antitrust jurisprudence has become way, way harder for plaintiffs. So that's why it's 6 years between, until the finding of class certification. And even that is a major victory. That's why there needs to be both public enforcement as well as, in my view, legislative amendments. And, there's some chance of that. There's a monopolization bill that's been introduced in the New York State Legislature that I think is promising. And I think there may be similar efforts in other states, especially in light of Prop 22. Right. In California, I think a lot of labor organizations and workers are afraid of this diminution of their status sort of marching across the states, including on the federal level. They're absolutely right to be very afraid of that. One of the ways to defend against that is to have very strong antitrust enforcement against what's called vertical restraints in the antitrust context, namely the ways in which dominant employer of independent contractors exercises its power. If that's made illegal through the antitrust laws or through public enforcement, then the attraction of the independent contractor business model is way reduced, because it exposes you [S2] Right. [S1] To exactly that liability. I think you started by saying we're going to be hearing more and more about monopsony. I hope that's specifically true in the context of the sort of defense against the gigification or platformization of the labor market across all sorts of occupations.
So this is just going to be that's what's interesting about this story, is that it has got the antitrust element to it. It's also got the labor element to it. And that's not always the case. We can see antitrust maybe in terms of, let's say, we're seeing it obviously in terms of Facebook, in terms of Google, in terms of Amazon, different variants in terms of what they're doing to the market that inhibits competition for other people. There's also issues, of course, in terms of, what happens when someone's deplatformed and then there's only one social platform. But we also see it in the context of other businesses outside of, we see it in airlines. And I mean, we're antitrust is going to be across the board. Where else would you guess? I mean, is the gig economy stuff, is this, when we look at this case and people start to follow it more, the gig economy is really going to be implicated by this because of that dynamic of independent contractors. And we should say, and just be clear, there are two competing forces here, because 22, which just passed in California, essentially they are looking to roll out this, which is a full-on assault on our labor laws, essentially across the entire country, where you as a worker will lose protections and will lose benefits because of this law, because it really is a sort of a backdoor to undercutting our labor laws, right? So this case has the opportunity to sort of bring up a new theory on how you inhibit this push by these gig economy entities.
Yeah, and that's what's, I would say, most important to me as a public message coming out of this. I mean, these are, you know, extremely exploited workers in a crappy situation who deserve relief. I think the relevance of that larger, of that situation to the larger labor market that the rest of us make our living in is exactly what you're saying. And in pushing this reduction in labor standards across the board that will hit all manner of occupations, you know, the companies will say, as I was earlier alluding to, oh, but the workers gain flexibility. So it's actually, you know, sort of a trade-off for them, and the workers like that trade-off. I think this antitrust as a defense against that highlights exactly the extent to which that isn't true, that you do not gain flexibility. You lose flexibility because as an independent contractor, you can be forced to do what it is the platform wants to work, even though it's not in your interest to, for the customers, that's in the interest of the platform for you to work for, not in your own interest. And I think, and it's important to open up this other front. So, you know, the sort of fight about the gig economy to date has almost solely been about employment status, employment classification. I think a lot of gig economy workers, you know, look at that kind of policy fight and think, well, you know, being an employee is not all that great shakes. I mean, look at the way that Walmart workers are employees. You know, they're totally screwed. So, like, why should I put my livelihood on the line to fight for something that it doesn't seem like is all that valuable to me? Well, I think the antitrust case sort of opens up another front, a front that is in fact, in some ways, a more pro-worker one, where it's fighting exactly the lack of autonomy, the subjugation of individual workers under the independent contractor business model. And my you know, ideal state would be if the platforms face severe antitrust liability as a result of using this independent contractor business model, then that their incentives change. Then they want to be made into, they want to, the workers to be made into employees, because that's how they get out of that liability. Like, thus far, they've been able to skate on that side of things. So they're happy to just say, you know, independent contractor, independent contractor, independent contractor, not, you know, because they don't face any harm from doing that. If independent contractor entails vertical restraints liability on the part of the platforms, then that decision on their part becomes a lot more complicated, and hopefully, you know, screwing over workers becomes less attractive to them.
It's fascinating the many different angles that we can take and that are necessary, I think, to constrain these companies that increasingly have so many resources in which they can change statutes and whatnot. So this is
I mean, they have basically an infinity budget. You know, when I looked at the what happened to Uber and Lyft share price in response to the passage of Prop 22, and you think, you know, that is you know, tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of workers having their livelihood be reduced to benefit the portfolio valuation of the Saudi royal family. Like, that just right there on its face is the hollowing out and destruction of the American middle class to benefit, you know, the world's richest and most powerful and despotic people. And I think, you know, we need to bring to bear new tactics and strategies to do something about that, because, you know, the American people are being sold out, frankly, by our existing political leadership.
I mean, there you go. I mean, you just you're taking the money from the employees or the contractors, as it were, and just putting it right into the share price, and it goes to I mean, that the perfect upward distribution of money. Marshall Steinbaum, next time we're going to talk more about college loan forgiveness. Maybe we can wait. Nothing's going to happen on that, at least until January 20th. And then hopefully maybe something will. We have time to talk about it. But thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem. Great talking to you.
Thanks so much.
All right. Quick break. Be right back. Well, yesterday was a big day, Emma, because that's the day that Mitch McConnell conceded that Joe Biden had won the presidency. And
6 weeks after he actually did?
Yeah. I mean, better late than never.
Sure.
And, of course, the right is up in arms. And I don't want to give – I think, like, even with – even noting that it took him 6 weeks, it almost gives him too much credit. The –
That was not my intention.
Well, yes, I know. And and but they are concerned, and Mitch McConnell warned members of his caucus that this is inhibiting Georgia. And again, this is all part of a whole, right? I mean, if Georgia, of course, is paramount to Mitch McConnell. Mitch McConnell will be able to do nothing. He will be able to obstruct in terms of legislation, but not necessarily when it comes to spending money. He will have to fight every piece of legislation. If the Democrats have 50 senators, have a tiebreak vote coming from Kamala Harris. And
especially because the 2022 map could be bad for Republicans if Democrats, you know,
if Democrats are able to provide some material benefit to people and right. show that they can legislate. And of course, it also means the beginning of attempting to push back on Mitch McConnell's packing of these courts. If McConnell has a majority of the Senate, then he will run the exact same plan he did against Obama when it comes to judicial appointees. And the Democrats won't be able to do anything about it. So Georgia is hugely important. And, you know, the question is, and this is, you know, I will concede this is a difficult, this is a difficult calculation to make. How much do you push in terms of what needs to be in this relief bill? And potentially keep it from happening. When you know that Mitch McConnell desperately wants something to pass, anything to pass, really. And
which means you up what you ask for.
And the question is, I guess, how far up do you you make that ask? And
luckily, it seems like stimulus checks will be included. But Jeff Stein of The Washington Post is also reporting that that means that the timeline for extended unemployment will be shortened. That's the trade-off.
So there's no extra money here in that bill. What we're looking at is simply a redistribution from people who are out of work. And then, of course, that puts the pressure on if the Democrats don't take the Senate by winning these two seats in Georgia, when we come back for that second bite at the apple to get extended unemployment benefits, because, look, we're going to be in this with COVID regardless of vaccinations into the spring at a minimum.
Minimum. I was going to say summer.
At a minimum. At a minimum. That means that Joe Biden and the Democrats have to go back to Mitch McConnell and say, please, please, please. And they don't have the leverage at that point. So, again, there's few opportunities for Democrats to have leverage. And if you don't use it now, you're going to lose it. And
use it or lose it.
Indeed. So but we will see. I suspect that we're going to have a deal by certainly by the end of the week, maybe before then. They're also, you know, let's face it, the senators want to go on vacation.
Yeah,
we all do. But the senators really like to go
and
on
Bernie
vacation.
Sanders is like, we'll stay here through Christmas if we have to. They're like, oh, geez. No,
all right, fine.
Hang out
here's another
guy.
$300. I mean, let's hope that. That is effective. All right, folks, we'll be back tomorrow. If you are anywhere on the Northeast, batten down the hatches. Got a big storm heading in our direction, but we'll be here one way or the other.
Maybe.
Right here. And don't forget, if you miss any part of this show, you can check it out on the Peacock app on the Choice channel, 5 p.m., 10 p.m. Check it out. See you tomorrow. And for those of you sticking around, we have much more show for you. We will take your phone
content, content.
Phone calls, IMs, an update on who the latest person that Jimmy Dore's got into a fight with.
Oh my God.
Real movement builder. But we will get to that in a moment. Just a reminder, this program relies on your support. You can become a member by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. And when you do, you support, you not only support the free show, but you get extra content just about every single day. Don't forget, Nomiki's show. You can find that at youtube.com and Nomiki, the Nomiki show. I'm not sure who's on today. But check it out. Also, the Antifada is doing a Twitch stream tonight at 7 p.m. So you can go to twitch.tv/theAntifada. It's all soft launch. But I'm not exactly sure what the difference is going to be between soft launch and hard launch.
Me neither.
You'll know when the time comes.
Well, we had a soft launch for this show. And even then, that was 10 years ago.
Right.
Couldn't really tell you what the difference was. It was just my way of basically saying I'm a little more sloppy. Maybe that's what
it's like. I want to continue putting out content without really making sure everything's done correctly in the back end. So I think that's what soft launch means. That's what we're doing in Left Reckoning too. Which, by the way, David Griscom did a Griscom stream last night. So check that out at Left Reckoning's YouTube channel.
There you go. Do you know what the name of that is? It YouTube.com, the Left Reckoning?
I don't think we have. I think you need to get a certain level of YouTube clout before you can specify your URL, so you have to search it. Yeah.
Well, with that said, speaking of YouTube clout, folks.
We got to get there.
I don't even think we added any subscribers. Did we? How did we do yesterday in terms of subscribers?
We did great. Just say that.
We did great yesterday.
Yeah.
But I want to do even better today. So, subscribe. Oh, we got to shoot that. We got to shoot that little tag for it too. All right, folks. See you in the fun half.
RM for it.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half. Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Back, 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 back. Boy, back. And the alpha males are back. Back.
Just as delicious as you can imagine.
The alpha males are back. Back, 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 back. Boy, back. And the alpha males are back. Back, back, back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back. Back.
I take all of it in my cross.
Alpha males are back.
Almost says what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You are a madman!
And the alpha males are back, back, back.
I am a total cunt.
Can we bring back DJ the Anarchy song, please?
Yeah, or a couple of them. Just put them in rotation.
DJ Danner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough of a break.
That's fucking nonsense.
Hey, fuck your mind.
I do not have Parkinson's.
And the alpha males are
psych. Fuck them. Fuck them.
Almost says what?
What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What?
What? What? What?
What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What?
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
The alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black. African. And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black.
Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100.
Can't knock the hustle.
Come on! Fuck them! Fuck them! Fuck them!
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
Fuck!
by the way, it's my birthday. It's my birthday. Happy birthday to me, Jew boy.
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black.
Come on. What? Come on. What? Come on. Someone needs to pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am a total
pussy.